Just before we get into this podcast, just a quick note from Henry and I. We absolutely love hosting the Badminton Podcast, but whilst juggling full-time jobs and bearing the costs of the editing so that we can bring you higher quality episodes and regular episodes, we would love your support. And you can support us through our Patreon account where you can pledge just a little bit per month. That's just going to help the Badminton Podcast keep running regularly and to keep serving your badminton needs. So when you can, please log on to www.patreon.com/thebadmintonpodcast, no spaces, and pledge a small amount. It's just really going to help us to keep this podcast going. Thanks a lot.
Brought to you from Melbourne, Australia, this is the Badminton Podcast, a community for badminton players by badminton players, where we talk badminton, celebrate local heroes, interview players from all walks of life, and push you to grow as a player and a person. Introducing your hosts, Jeff and Henry.
Welcome to another episode of the Badminton Podcast, proudly brought to you by Volantwear. And together, what we're doing is showing the world how incredible badminton is because we really love the sport. We're coming live. Not live, but I'm sitting right next to my guest because we are in Kuala Lumpur for the 2020 Malaysia Masters. And because of that, my co-host Henry can't be here with me. So I'm going to take this on my own. So my guest sitting next to me, his name's Sam McGee, and I'm sure a lot of people know his name and know all about him, but I'm going to introduce him anyway. He's from Ireland, and his current world ranking is 31 in mixed doubles with his sister Chloe McGee. He's the current European medalist from the recent European Games, which was held in Minsk in Belarus. He's been a professional player for the last 12 years and has been based in Sweden and Denmark before returning back to Ireland in 2013 to their national centre in Dublin.
Believe that you can do the best you possibly can, and then I think it's much mental training to get yourself as tough as possible, because there's a lot of factors, like even coming to Asia and you're losing first round, you can't let your, you know, you can't become dejected, you just have to keep working.
Keep training.
Always look and find that rather than, you know, what you're going through. There is a lot of things where you can get lost along the way, and you got to keep yourself, you know, towards your own goal. And I think staying in control of your mind and working on that as much as possible is huge for badminton.
Sam also plays in the top flight league badminton in the German Bundesliga with TV Refrath. Did I say that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. Impressive introduction there, I think, Sam. So European medalist, world ranking of 31, and on the road to Tokyo 2020.
Yeah, that's the goal at the minute, is to try and qualify for Tokyo. At the minute, where I think we're still out on the list, so still chasing points.
Yeah, it's a bit like that. There's so many people out there, and we were talking about it before, and your world ranking being 31 at the moment at the time of recording, but it's been fluctuating between that high 20 to that 31 position for a while, just because all the players are competing so fiercely for those positions.
Yeah, the points is, you know, everyone's chasing points, and the ranking's changing a lot because there's a lot of pairs coming up that haven't been playing for the last couple of years. And then there's a lot of pairs that have been playing really well since the Olympic qualifying, and also some pairs that have split and gone the opposite way. So the ranking is changing every week for many different reasons.
Absolutely. But yeah, so first of all, I just want to say thanks so much for coming on.
No problem.
And spending your time. He just came back from a training session in hot, humid Malaysia in no air conditioning, and really feeling the brunt of the Malaysian weather here while we're training. So Sam, I personally know about your story because we didn't meet formally. We met on court back in 2007 at the Norwegian International, I remember. And we played singles against each other. And I believe that was the last tournament you played singles in.
Yeah, that was my last singles. Not for the reason that I lost. It was just one of those things where afterwards, of course, I lost, and I thought I wanted to train more doubles. I enjoyed doubles training much more because, for people who don't understand, singles is really long and tough training. You're out there by yourself.
By yourself.
Where doubles, sometimes, it's of course, it's tough and hard as well, but it's more like quick reactions. and things happen faster. And normally the routines aren't as killer as singles, but it's just, it's more quick and reactive, and it's just a different world, really.
Yeah, it completely is. And I also can empathize with you, because when, especially when you're a smaller country, which we're going to talk about later, but when you're a small country and a singles player, when you're a small country, you already don't have many people around you. And when you're a singles player as well, it does feel very alone when you're going and traveling those international tournaments by yourself.
Yeah, I think like in Ireland at the minute, we have one main singles player that's also traveling, is Nat. And yep. He's also in Malaysia at the minute, training at Sports Affair. So, but he also finds out now that he's with me and Chloe a lot at the minute. But we're at different stages of tournaments. We're at the higher level and he's coming up. But he's finding that where he's going to have to go to a lot of tournaments, especially in Asia by himself. Yeah. So then you're relying on a lot of things. You don't have your own sparring partners and different stuff. So it brings a huge challenge being a singles player. Even doubles, you know, you're there with a partner at least. So you've always got someone, right? Yeah, you've always got someone. But singles players are normally on their own in smaller countries.
Yeah, definitely. So in terms of the background of yourself and your brothers and your sister and the whole McGee family, you do have a really good reputation in building the sport in Ireland. So can you give us a bit of an introduction of how your family got involved, how you got involved, and what everyone's doing now?
Yeah, we started, you know, just when we were young. There was no real professional badminton in Ireland, so it was kind of like a new thing. So we were just playing when we were young against each other, no real coaching, very raw, you know, just playing and, you know, having that competitive with brothers and sisters. We were on the Irish team when we got to maybe 16, 17, and then Chloe was the first to go professional. She went to Sweden, and I then the next year, once I finished school, I also went to Sweden. And then Dan, my older brother, he was an international, but he went into the coaching route. I think the professional system probably just came a little bit too early from him, and then he went more down that way, and he was probably one of the first real professional, like, doing coaching for a living in Ireland. And then after that, Chloe returned home from Sweden. She was kind of like preferred to be at home at that stage, and I went to Denmark for a few years, so both of us were still playing professionally and competing together. So it just all came together. There was no real plan that everyone would play, you know, that we would go down this. I'm sure my parents are pretty shocked to me.
That you all picked it up?
Yeah, my dad did play, but I think they're more shocked that it's now her job, like it's her occupation, and Dan's now the head coach. And then of course my brother Josh came along as well. He was quite determined. We weren't sure if he was gonna, you know, play as well, but he just got into it, and then he just couldn't really give it up. So he's also a player now, and he plays men's doubles and singles for Ireland too. So that's it. And then my older sister, her daughter now plays, so that's her niece, is now part of the national center as well.
Yeah,
so it's really unique, but it's something that really came about by chance more than anything else. It wasn't something that, okay, we were going to be professionals when we were young. We just played and enjoyed, and then things just fell into place. Like when we went to Sweden, there was an Irish coach there, but he was from Ireland, but he represented America in the Olympics. His name was Tom Reedy.
Okay, I'm not sure.
No, and so he had played in the Olympics for America, but then met a Swedish lady and was living in Sweden where he had a family and was working in a club. So it's just by off chance, some contacts a man there and says, okay, because there's no set up profession there. And he says, okay, maybe contact Tom and see if he wants to help out. So he had an Irish heart, so he wasn't really interested in, you know, being anything for band in Ireland, but he had working in a Swedish club, and he took us on board over there. So all these things that just, you know, happened by, you know, complete chance that we ended up being professionals.
Yeah. That's crazy. It sounds so orchestrated. As in, if someone was looking from the outside, there's you, there's your sister, there's your brother doing the coaching, your other brother playing doubles and singles and then your niece. It just seems like a whole McGee Island kind of mix up there.
Sure. Yeah. I think like for me and Chloe, it was more by chance, but then Josh and Rachel come along, they kind of seen what we were doing, got playing, and then went on with that. But like, I think our story is a complete chance. Like then I went to Denmark where Scott Evans was training. Like he was the first person that went professional in Ireland, so he kind of led the way. But he went to an academy in Denmark and then moved to a club. And then lucky Jim Laugesen, who was the coach there, got involved with Bands in Ireland. So that was kind of like the first center of Bands in Ireland, where a couple of players came together and started training.
Yeah.
And like that was just by chance as well. Like a club in Denmark that would take in five Irish players at that time. So
yeah,
it's just all these things that happened. So I just, when I look at it, I always think, you know, it's, I know maybe it's fate or something, but it just, everything happened like piece by piece. There was nothing, there was never no long-term plan to play for as long as we did or how we did.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. And You might get this question a lot because there's not many brothers and sisters that play with each other. Well, professionally, I actually don't know of any except, well, husband and wife, which is the Adcocks.
Yeah.
How does it go? Is there a bit of fighting on the court? Is there a bit of that stuff, especially initially when you're younger? Or is it kind of tamed down now? Or
I think the only other one I know is Marcus Keto used to play with his sister.
Yes, that's true.
That's the only other one that I can think of. And maybe Oliver Layden Davis.
Yes, and Susanna, yes.
Yeah. So maybe that's two. I don't know.
Okay,
I
can't maybe think two, of, yeah.
Yeah, but I think me and Chloe have maybe been playing the longest. But I think when you're younger, of course, you don't really understand things and you argue over bad performance and stuff. But as we got older, we worked a little bit with a sports psychologist for a while just to structure things, like how we should speak to each other, because we're completely different people. Chloe just likes to do things. I'm always overthinking things and, you know, we're different people.
Yeah.
So I think at the start, when we had that initial sports psychology to structure things, just to how to say things and when we should speak about matches before and after, and, you know, after a loss or a victory, whatever, it's always different. So it was just that sort of structuring. But I think it is tough with family because you also spend more time with them outside.
Yes.
You have family events.
Yeah, it's difficult to kind of split.
To separate.
Are you good at separating the...
Me and Chloe, we don't spend a lot of time together outside of badminton.
Okay.
You know, when we come to Asia, we're in each other's pockets all the time. So when we're outside of badminton, we don't, maybe, you know, Sunday we have some family time where we're together, but other than that, we're normally quite separate, do our own thing. We have different friends, and so we don't really spend so much time. I think that helps a lot.
Yeah.
Maybe some other balloons that might be closer outside, but when you're every day, Monday to Friday training.
I think you
see enough of each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And did you find that when you first started playing together, was it by chance as well? Was it more by chance? Did you play a tournament and do really well and think we should do this? Or was it just, hey, there's not as many players in Ireland, we have to play together because there's no one at the level we want?
Yeah, I think it was more or less by chance, to be honest. It was like Chloe was playing singles as her predominant event. Mm. And then I was at tournaments playing doubles, so we just played nearly as an extra event. And it was only up until after Chloe finished in Rio that we really started playing mixed, like, seriously. Even though our ranking was maybe top 50, which helped us get funding in Ireland. Yep. If you get top 50, you get funding. We didn't really, like it wasn't really a focus at all until after Rio. Which, where Chloe said, okay, enough with singles. I'd like to try for the next Olympic and mixed and see how it goes. So that was when it really became proper, to be honest.
Yeah. When did you first start then?
Oh, we've been playing for... Yeah, since I've been 18, like every year since I've been professional playing in Sweden, we have played like a minimum of maybe 8 tournaments per year, but nothing like so structured as we are now, playing over 20 tournaments per year.
Yeah.
So I think it's been a long time now. It's probably been about 12 years we've been playing together.
Yeah.
In different ways. Like it always hasn't been as focused as it has now.
Yeah. So at the moment you're back in Dublin and you're training in the National Centre there. What's the structure look like there? Are there many players? How's badminton in Ireland in general? Is it growing?
Yeah, it's been getting better. When I moved back, there was a guy called Richard Vaughan. He came in. He took over badminton and he really gave it a big shake up, really made it professional, got a center going.
Oh, fantastic.
Did all these things, did a lot of work outside that was unseen, and got different funding together to make a center, to get tournaments funded and all this. So it was a huge step forward for badminton Ireland. And it's growing, it's steadily growing. I think it's kind of like, it's reached a point now where it's quite stable, it's getting better. It's got a better reputation with the Irish Sports Council, funding with European medals and stuff. And at the minute we have about, I think, 10 players in the centre. Probably 5 of us that would be full-time. Yes. And then the rest are balancing them with study.
Study or work.
Yeah, so it's quite... Yeah. It is tough, but it's getting more and more players. And then we have an academy that runs alongside it, which I think is brilliant for Ireland. You know, they can see it, but they can also see, okay, I want to be in there someday. So there's more pathways coming. It's just because there hasn't been a tradition in Ireland, like other countries, we even have a lot of ex-players that have had a high world rank and we don't have that at all.
Yeah.
So it's like getting the coaches. Normally that kind of has a rebound effect. A percentage of them might go into coaching and pass on. We haven't got that. So I think we're kind of like the first generation now, like from Scott, he's in coaching, but he's in Denmark.
Yeah.
So hopefully like Chloe, myself, I'm not sure if Chloe, but I would like to go into coaching. So hopefully this next, I think the next generation, hopefully we'll have more things. But slowly but steadily, there's more academies popping up. There's a bigger demand to play for sure. And
yeah,
I think a lot of the young players now can see, okay, I can do something in this. You know, when I was growing up, there was no role models. There were some players playing, but maybe they would go abroad 4 times a year or 5 times a year, maybe at most, but not no setup, just doing their own thing.
Yeah.
So now I think it's there's the structure there for Ireland to get better, and things are getting better each year. But I think it's now making that next push, hopefully getting more players professional. It's hard because there's not a lot of revenue for a young player starting out. You gotta like put in a lot of hard work, and then you're relying on playing clubs in Europe, and hopefully a sponsor can give you something to help you fund. But and then you have to get a ranking inside the top 50 before you get funding from every sports council, which is getting harder and harder to do every year.
There's good players from every country now, so.
Yeah, that's what we see. Like even now, the smaller tournaments in Europe, there might be a squad comes from Taiwan, or a squad comes from Japan,
like a junior squad or a B team. And they're so strong.
Exactly. So all these Asian countries, and then you never know, maybe China might start in younger squads. You never know. Yeah. So I think it's just getting harder and harder to make like top 50 and stuff like that. So hopefully the next generation, they have their work cut out from them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm not sure. Richard Vaughan's in Australia now.
He's in Squash Australia.
CEO of Squash Australia. So must be doing good things there. He sounds like he did a really good job in Ireland.
He did a very good job, yeah. He really put structure in place. So it's more like he did a good job and he's there, but he also left a legacy. So things are still going.
The way that he set them up to an extent.
He had to make some hard decisions, of course, when you do that.
Yeah.
You're not going to please everyone.
Yeah, definitely.
But he definitely does some great things. And the fact that there's a centre there, if he hadn't done anything else, that's one huge thing.
Yeah, that's one huge, yeah.
That's going to last a long time, hopefully, if the players keep recycling into it.
Yeah, and we were talking about this before, Sam, when you were saying you've got a bit more funding because you've got some good results at, say, European Games, and you're getting more funding, but then we need to back it up so that when you do decide to hang up the professional rackets, per se, then there's someone to pick it up and keep getting your results so the funding keeps coming. Otherwise, it might dry up, and then there's a new generation that has to start from nothing again like you did.
Yeah, that's a huge problem. But I think I'm not sure, but a lot of countries, I think it's the same. You're constantly looking for results to show your either federation or government or something to say, okay, can we get some funding off the back of this? And in Ireland, we were lucky we have European medals, which is one of the targets. And of course, the next targets are World and Olympic medals, which are, for small countries, extremely hard.
Yeah.
So like, it's really getting down to a percentage of, you know, that will be the next level in Ireland. If we want to get to another level of funding, it's World medals. And the step from European to Worlds is
massive.
Huge. Like, it's quite uncomparable. But so hopefully now, if we can keep hitting European medals, then maybe in 20, 30, 40 year time, if you can build up enough players,
then,
to make a better squad, which is hard to do as well, but everything depends on funding. So every year, if we can keep getting players to get European medals, hopefully even like get some juniors start doing well, which is also an easier option, but it doesn't guarantee funding, but it's someone to say, okay, someone's coming, which helps with funding too. You mightn't get funding off it, but if you can show that people are coming, there's more leniency with the sports councils. But it is a huge pressure. Every year you have to try and get results, and even Band in Ireland have targets for us that we have to maintain, because once you get to a certain age, they want more results, and there's always pressure, as I'm sure there is in every country.
You were talking about the big step from European Games to, say, Olympic Games in the world stage. It would be really nice if you had that kind of middle in between, which is Commonwealth Games, isn't it?
For sure.
So for those listening whose geography isn't that great, look, I didn't actually know this until I actually traveled over there in 2007 and 8, but Ireland is not part of the UK. I just thought it was for some reason. It's Northern Ireland that's part of it, and Ireland is part of Europe, so the EU. So Sam was telling me before, I'll let him tell the story, but he can't play Commonwealth Games, even though he lives so close to Northern Ireland itself.
Yeah, it's quite crazy. I don't even know how to go about explaining it, but I live really close to the border in Northern Ireland and in the north of Ireland.
Yeah, it's actually in the north part of Ireland.
It's probably the most northern part, the top of the county where I'm from. But I live like a 5-minute drive from the north, but I don't have any connections in the north. So actually, when I drive from my home to training, I have to go through Northern Ireland to Dublin. which is also another thing with the whole Brexit situation of, you know, Britain leaving the EU. So in Ireland, we're quite affected by it because they want to build borders again.
Yes.
Which there hasn't been for a long time. There's been free travel and, you know, people coming from Northern Ireland to get their petrol because it's cheaper, and people shopping in Northern Ireland because it's cheaper and things like this. So there's a lot of issues there with Brexit in the UK. And it's two completely different countries because Northern Ireland, they spend pounds, miles per hour, yeah, different things. And in Ireland, we're euros, kilometres. Yeah. And, you know, it is different, but it is annoying because Commonwealth Games is... looking from the outside, it just looks like such a great event.
Yeah.
And in Bamden, you also have big countries like England, Malaysia, India, Singapore, which is a great step.
It's a great step, isn't it? Great step into the world stage.
Yeah, because like before European Games, like it's really hard for me to qualify in mixed for Olympics, so it would have been a great platform, you know, to get that experience. And if it wouldn't have been for European Games, as I said, like, you know, I've never had a multi-team event where you're not just Bamden.
Yeah.
You know, and that is different as well when you're coming to these events and you're part of a bigger team where athletes, you know, they're going to compete and you're competing, you're coming back to the same team place. You know, I've never had that before, which is something that is different.
Yeah.
You feel more of like, because in Bamden, you're in a smaller country, you're here by yourself, where when you go to a multi-sport event, you're part of
the whole Irish team, right?
And it's and there's more officials, there's more physio, there's better care.
Yeah, and just the team spirit is completely different.
Exactly.
So
it's a different feeling for sure, because there's just, you know, they put so much effort into it when there's so many Irish athletes there.
Yeah. I've been lucky enough to go to two Commonwealth Games, and not to rub it in your face or anything, but I can just imagine that, yeah, it's such a great experience, and I really hope that you can go to Olympic Games, because from the people that I've spoken to between Commonwealth Games and Olympic Games, in the words of one of my good teammates, Glenn Wharf, and I'm sure you know Glenn, he said, Olympic Games is like Commonwealth Games on steroids. So hopefully you can just go straight to Olympics, and then you've ticked off Commonwealth Games. You don't need to worry about that.
Sure. It's like, because I've never been to the Olympics, I've heard so many stories from Scott and Chloe about how big it is. So I think even like to go, if I was to go to Tokyo, there'd be such a big event to get your head around. You know, there's so many stars there and different aspects.
Just all sports, right?
Yeah. It's worldwide. There's so much more media. Like in Ireland for the last 2 years now, it's kind of hyping up. The media is getting into the athletes that they don't normally cover, you know, in different sports that would be on TV. And there's a lot of hype in Ireland, even now for Olympics and things starting to take place. The ads are starting to come on TV, you know, there's a lot of atmosphere for it.
Okay, fantastic. So let's move on to traveling around in the Irish team. So at the moment we're in Malaysia, and the Irish team is a team of two, yourself and Chloe, your sister. And that's similar for the Australian team. We only have two players here. And it is a bit tricky. So a lot of the listeners may not understand how different it is for smaller countries trying to compete, not just on court, but just all the logistics around training, venues, etc. What do you find difficult? What are the challenges being a smaller country entering these big tournaments?
Yeah, I think I understand that a bigger team also has bigger problems, with logistics and stuff. But I think as a smaller team, you get like less court time to train. You know, the bigger teams, it's 30 minutes per player. You know, the big teams might have, like Japan might have 20 players, so they get more court time, how they divide it. So I think things like that, and then smaller teams get put together on court, so you have to, you know, compromise and get your own training. So it is different, the time you get to spend, but it's also like in Ireland, it takes a huge cost out of our budget to send a coach to these events. So sometimes we have come to these events, as I'm sure Australia and other teams in America, you see, sometimes they don't have a coach.
No coach.
So they have to, you know, you got to sort things like manager meeting, which is compulsory. And of course, if you're at these events, there's a lot of chance you're going to meet a big player and lose in the early round. So then you've got to do your own training, and then you've got to find people to play with. Where the bigger teams, you know, they're a big squad. They might have 3-4 men's doubles pairs or mixed pairs. So maybe two of them might lose early, and then they can spar together.
Still got really good training,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. So you can look on, and like the big teams have a lot of things going for them that, you know, they also have like maybe three in the top 10. So it's like, you know, real quality.
Yeah.
Where in the smaller countries, you're never gonna really produce that sort of players. Like the best you can hope for is maybe two in one event that's good. So there is a lot of different things. At this event, like we have hired a Malaysian coach to cut down costs, and also because he can bring some different ideas and you know, he's living here at home, so cut down your flights and accommodation. So there is different things. I think there's ways you can do, you know, as much as you can, but it's still hard when you're here at the bigger tournaments.
Yeah, I'm not sure of many other teams or players who have set up what you've done. Mm-hmm. So basically, instead of having to spend the money to fly a coach over from Ireland to coach you, but to have a coach here in Malaysia and in Asia that can help you just while you're here, so that you don't have to incur those costs of the flights. Of course, you have to pay them, mm-hmm. but yeah. Do you know of any other teams doing that?
I know of people that go, like, would use Malaysia and use their academies to come and play. But I think it's like what we're doing is a little bit lucky, because Tan Bin Shen's quite open with his time, where he can get people to cover his academy.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot of coaches that could maybe go on the road for 3 weeks, just random. You know, we maybe call him a month before and he can say, yes, I can do it. So I think it's tricky finding the people. So it is tricky finding coaches in different capacities, no matter what. But I think it is hard for teams to do that. I can't really think offhand anyone that does. Maybe like the Korean independent players, you see they have maybe Cook and Cat back of the court, and maybe that's something, you know, they've done the same as us.
Yeah, sure.
But I don't know the setup either, so I can't really say, but that's what it looks like. And also I don't know of any other teams that really do it, but I know that there is players that link up with academies and maybe use academy coach if they can.
Yeah, or just train at the academy if they lose, and so they don't have to worry about the training when they lose, for example. Yeah, so it's very interesting, because I think the listeners might not understand that in terms of sharing in a courts. Now we're talking about trying to get into the main hall, for example, which is where the event is actually played, not just the training courts. And you've got maybe the smaller teams, you've got maybe three countries or more sharing one court for half an hour. Everyone's trying to get their on-court time before the tournament starts to get a feel of it. And it's just so tricky. Or if you look over the other side, yes, they've got more players, but they've got heaps of time to play on a range of courts. And as we know, the wind and the draft at each court is different. So as a bigger country, you've got maybe all the courts, so you can just shift across courts and just see how each court is. But let's just say you're on court four when you're playing your match, but your training court is on court two, then you have no idea how the wind or the draft is going to be on that side.
Yeah, exactly right. We had that this week where we trained with the Australian girls on court four, but our match was on court one. So, and on court four, there was a huge drift.
Yeah, I heard.
Like a huge drift, and both sides was completely different. Where in court one, it actually played quite normal. But I actually can't tell you what it was like in court four, because we played one match.
Yeah, exactly.
And then when I was watching court four, I didn't see anything to suggest that the drift was as crazy as we played. But it is, as you say, you know, the day we practiced, we were court four, but Indonesia had three other courts, so they were switching between three other courts.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, getting different experience in each one. So it is, there is lots of small factors. And like in other sports, it is more individual, where badminton is still like team oriented. Right. Your national association has a lot of power. I think it's quite hard for independent players. Maybe this is going off track, but you know, your national association has to enter your tournaments. Your prize money goes to your national association. So I think if you have an argument or a disagreement, you know, I don't think it's not like individuals.
Yeah.
And it's something that I think some players are starting to voice about, because it's quite different that this, you know, your federation still has control over you.
Even if you're independent.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's, I think that's another killer fish to deal with, independent players and what they're entitled to in national federations. So
yeah, it is. It's very hard for independent players to do their own thing.
Mm. And with regards to the training, I find that being from another small country, not in size, but in badminton size, in Australia, that when we do go for training sessions, we have to help each other a lot more. So we'll find that we'll try to tee up training with different countries so that we've got sparring, we've got practice, because it's hard to train for mixed doubles when it's just you and your sister on court, isn't it?
Exactly.
So if you didn't have Tan Bin Shen and you weren't training at his academy, then you'd have to physically go to the effort and line up other people to train with.
Yeah, exactly. So in the past years, we have collaborated with, you know, say the French or the Dutch, that sometimes are coming with one mixed pair as well. A lot of the times, even the European countries have two pairs, so they're not so interested in sharing their court time, which makes sense for them, because they have their own players to worry about and they have sparring. So it is tricky. It does throw up. We're lucky in Malaysia, we have Tan Bin Shen, and in Malaysia, there's a lot of club players. that are outside their system, and they also are quite keen to play with different players. But still, it is still quite hard to get people to come and play because everyone's tied to their own thing. But it's a tricky situation. And then, of course, you're competing against these players as well.
Yeah.
So everyone's looking for their own advantage, and everyone's looking for their own interest, which is fair enough.
It's fair enough. Everyone's here to
do a job, and you know everyone's relying on results. So.
And the race to Tokyo is on. On like crazy.
Yeah.
The amount of competition, like we said before, is crazy. Now, speaking about competition in itself, we have discussed previously in other episodes of the podcast about the differences between, say, Asian training, European training, and basically subtle differences. But of course, because they train differently, the players play a lot differently as well. So if we're going to go to more of a tactical or gameplay situation for you and Chloe, if you were going to give a blanket overview about the differences between your styles when you have to play against Asian pairs compared to European pairs, how does your game change? Of course, it's going to vary from pair to pair because they have different strength, but just as a general rule, what would you say the differences are between what you do on court when you play Asians compared to Europeans?
Yeah, I think there's such a difference, especially in mixed. The Asian girls are always very strong and fast, and the European girls are as well, but they are more like, the European girls are more focused on being on the net and skillful. Where we played a Japanese pair this week, and the girl's defense was very good. She wasn't as concerned to come into the net, but because her defense was, you know, so capable. She's world number one, or was world number one in ladies doubles. But I think in general, it's, you know, the Asians are very physical. They play fast and quick, and they can blow you off court by their speed alone. And I think the Europeans is maybe more tactical. I don't think we can compete with how crazy and quick the Asian players are working. But I have been very lucky because I trained in Denmark and I was in their system where it's really thoughtful training. Everything has a purpose. You play the shuttle here for this reason, to play for your partner or a tactical reason. And then when I came back to Ireland, we had an Indonesian coach, Irwan Saya. He's now the second men's singles coach in Indonesia.
Indonesia, yeah.
So he was our coach for that period from 2013 till the Rio Olympics.
Okay, I didn't know. When did he move from Wales?
Yeah, he moved from Wales that year.
Okay.
After 2012. I think it could have been 2013, but he was there in Ireland.
Yeah, sure.
So he was our coach from then until 2016.
Yeah.
Because he went to the Olympics with Scott and Chloe in Rio. So his training was very physical, like always
long.
Do more.
Yeah.
Always do more. So if you do heavy on Monday, you come on Tuesday and you do more on Wednesday more. And it was a lot of physical, a lot of heavy routines. For singles players, it was a lot of 30-minute exercise. Where in Denmark, the players there were maybe doing 2 minutes or 5 minutes or maybe 10 minutes at most, but a lot of quality. Where his was more like, do long durations and build yourself up to be tougher and harder and get one more shuttle back. And it was very physical, like a lot of running, a lot of agility work. It was a lot of heavy, heavy training on the body. And it's different ways of doing the same thing. I think for certain players, both things work. You can see for the Asians, their system is working. They have a lot of good players. The European style from Denmark, I think, fits quite well with the European way. I think the Asian style with Irwan was very hard on everyone. Like, it really made everyone, you know, physically.
Yeah.
You know, you were dead every single day. It was really, you know, you look back at that time in your life and you see how drained you were. Like, you don't really realize until you look back.
Look back, yeah.
And you see, like, your weekends were a blur because you were so tired. And then Monday morning would come along again. Like, not that the European training is easier, but it's just a different type of tiredness. You know, if you're doing a lot of 30-minute routines, compared to doing maybe 5 minutes or 2 minutes or whatever it is, it does make a change. So I think I'm lucky that I've had the experience of, you know, playing against the best Asian players and playing against the best European players, and then being coached by a top Asian coach and a top European coach. So I have some experience, but I think in general, the Asians are very physical, and the really top Asians are really physical and really good tactically. Where I think in Europe, a lot of the players are of course physically good, but it's the Asians are maybe a bit quicker, but the Europeans are normally tactically, you know, they put a lot of emphasis on how to play and structure.
Yeah, yeah. What I found also just from watching mixed doubles, now I'm in no way very good at mixed doubles. In actual fact, I dislike playing mixed doubles just because I don't know it very well. But what I found with the European players, I completely agree that they're more focused on the front court. And I do find that just from a perspective from European training, how much rear court training does a European mixed doubles female actually do? Because I always find that when they are stuck at the rear court, it's very, very hard for the pair to get out of it, compared to, you're saying, the Asian pairs, like they can defend, or they can, if the girl's on the female's on the rear court for a while, it doesn't matter too much. Do you find that as well?
Yeah, I would agree. I guess it depends on the girl, because I think if the girl is also playing ladies doubles,
yeah,
she's obviously doing a lot of work on backcourt, where Chloe is not playing ladies doubles as much, maybe a little bit in league, but
she was singles player before, yeah, so that makes a difference as well.
But I think she also is training more front court and mid court, that sort of area, to get forward, looking always really, that's the kind of more focus that she's on, and not doing a little bit here and there, but not maybe as much focus. Because I could see when we played against the Japanese girl, she's quite comfortable. Actually, one of the things we looked at their tactics was they were actually very good when she was in the back hitting.
And he was at the front.
Because he's a world-class doubles player, his net game is very good. So if she's smashing on me or Chloe and we don't have a good quality, it was going to be punished. We just, you know, from watching tactics. So I would agree. I think the girls that play ladies doubles are obviously doing a lot of rear court. And the ones that, but it's getting fewer and fewer girls that play both. I think it's getting pretty hard to do both, because the physical element of ladies doubles is getting more and more and more.
1.5 hour matches.
Yeah, it's a different, crazy. It's becoming like a different game. It's a different skill that's needed for ladies doubles than is for mixed.
Yeah, yeah. So based on the top European players that you played against, as well as the top Asian players, who do you actually prefer to play against? Would you prefer to play against Asian players or European players?
I think any of the Asian players that are at the top of the world are really hard to play against. The ones I've played against have been very good. The Europeans, I don't mind playing against them as much. I don't know. I actually don't really say. Some of the Asians can come and play quite open. You know, they just play wild, and it's whether you can match their speed or not. And some of them are tactically very good. I wouldn't say I have a preference. The top European pairs are also very good. The top English pairs, Denmark, always have good pairs. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually one of the events I think Europe's doing pretty well in.
Yeah.
You know, they have a lot of pairs at these tournaments. I would say they have more pairs in mixed than they might have in men's doubles at the minute. And that ladies doubles, there's quite a lot as well. So I think it's one of the events that Europe do quite well in, is mixed.
Yeah. And I do believe I saw some results. I'm not sure exactly which tournament it was, but you did have a victory over Yuta Watanabe and Risiga Shino. When was that one?
That was the Worlds in Glasgow. I'm not sure which year.
Maybe 17?
Yeah.
Maybe? That's just a guess.
Right. Yeah, that
maybe
could be
2017.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Year. That was probably maybe the first year that Chloe was fully focused on mixed.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a really, really good tournament there. I don't know whether it was because it was so close to Ireland, but we were able to beat Watanabe. I think he was a little bit younger then, and maybe not as experienced, but that was a really good win for me and Chloe. And then the next round, we were three sets with Natsir and Ahmad.
Yes.
And then they went on to win it. So that was a really good tournament for us. Yeah. I just think the hall in Scotland, quite unique. It's like the All Englands is quite slow,
okay,
so it can neutralize
the speed. Maybe. Yeah.
You know, you've got more, you can lift the shuttle and it doesn't come back as quick,
exactly,
you know, for the Asians. So I think these bigger halls in Europe can help, and it's also slow, but it's not really overly slow. So when you lift it, it's slow, but the flat plate
is still fast,
still quite quick, so it kind of suits Europeans. And then I think sometimes it is hard for the Asians to come to Europe when it's a little bit colder than what they're used to.
Yeah, don't take credit away from yourself.
No.
Because I do believe that was definitely after they won All England anyway.
Yeah, and they also, I think they had a good Sudirman Cup just before it in May. And then Ahmad Natsir went on to win the tournament. So
yeah.
We definitely were in really good form. I can't really pinpoint why, but it's just, you know, yeah. one of those tournaments where everything's working, and I was hoping we got a bit more break in the third against Athman Natsir, but, you know, they're absolutely, were yeah. world-class at that time, yeah. the best in the world, so we were really happy with that tournament.
Do you remember what you did, say, in the tournament that you did really, really well against, let's just say against Watanabe and Higashino, when you came away with the victory? If you remember, do you remember what exactly you did well and your tactics that helped you win?
I think we both moved really fast, but we kept a lot of control. We didn't play a lot of this flat game when we weren't really on top. Every time there was kind of 50-50, we just blocked the shuttle and made them try to do something, rather than when it was 50-50, take a chance in the flat. Yeah. And normally
just
the Asians are ready on that. And we really got our decisions spot on, which I think at this level is such a thin line. You know, all your small decisions can leave you 5 points down or can leave you like 2 points each. And that's a big difference if you're like 2-all or 5-love down. And then that happens at 10-all, you go 15-10 or 12-all. It's all these small decisions of, you know, just making one or two wrong. And once these guys get confidence and they get a lead, they're really hard to play. But that was the main thing against Watanabe as well. We always kept it close. The scoreboard never got away from us. A lot of the time we were leading in the two sets that we won. So I think those things are crucial. Once you let these guys get ahead, these Asian players, and they become a little bit more relaxed, then I think they can really go to town.
Yeah, you play freely.
Yeah, and exactly. But once you keep the scoreboard quite close, which is easier said than done, I think they can be vulnerable.
Yeah.
So, Sam, switching gears from playing against the Asian versus European players. Now, if there was someone who was playing mixed doubles and they really wanted to improve their game, for example, what would you think are the most important, just really easy fundamental things that you can talk about that's going to help them improve? Because personally, like I said, I'm not a fan of mixed doubles because I don't know the game very, very well. But what are some essentials?
I think everyone speaks about the mid-court, like controlling that mid-court flat area is very crucial. One of the big things I think I found when I first started playing the bigger tournaments was when you're in positions, everyone says below the level of the net, and it's quite vague, but when you're in these positions where it goes past the lady and you're taking the shuttle a little bit lower, the options from there you need to have are really crazy, because the better pairs you play against, the more times you're going to be in this position.
Yeah.
And you have to find a very good shot. Because if you play too loose to the net, the girl's going to be there. And if you play a bad quality to midcourt, the guy is there. And of course, if you lift against any world-class guy, they're going to be putting huge pressure. So I think this level below there, if you can improve that as much as possible, I think that's huge for mixed.
Sure. So do you mean the goal of the mixed game should be to get it below net level for your opponent?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And of course, the better players you play against, they're trying to do the same to you. And more often than not, they're going to have you in that position. So it's like they put you in that position and they see what answers you have. And if you don't have them, it's something you really have to work on. So it's like as a pair, and also like the technique needs to be really good in all these shots to bring up your quality.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Great. And then moving on from the badminton side of stuff with your career, because you've had so much success from such a young age, and you've been doing you've been playing professionally for 12 years. In terms of the challenges you've had along the way and what you've actually learned from them that, say, someone listening could bring into their game or into their life, do you have any words of wisdom or advice that helped you along your journey?
I think if I was to go back and also give people advice, I would say do a lot of mental training. Of course, your badminton training needs to be good. You need to have as much good training, good coach, good sparring, good weight setup, physio, all the rest. I think that, and if you don't have that, it's going to be a struggle. But I also think a lot of mental training. I think when you're younger, you always hear about mental training. And I think the more things you can do to improve your mind and not let circumstance define you, you know, because you come from a small country, you can't do this or that. I think you should always believe that you can do the best you possibly can. And then I think as much mental training to get yourself as tough as possible, because there's a lot of factors, like even coming to Asia and you're losing first round, you can't become dejected. You just have to keep working.
Keep training. Keep training the next day and keep going.
And yeah. I'm pretty sure if you look in any circumstance you're in, there's always been someone before you that has made a success of it. So always look and find that rather than, you know, what you're going through. There is a lot of things where you can get lost along the way, and you got to keep yourself, you know, toward your own goal. And I think staying in control of your mind and working on that as much as possible is huge for bouncing.
Sure. And when you say work on your mind and do mental training, it all seems very logical and common sense.
Yeah.
But how do you actually do it? Do you have something that you can impart? Just one exercise, whether it's concentration exercise, visualization, is there something that you can impart on the audience that they know they need to do the mental training, but what is mental training?
Yeah, like? I think first of all, for everyone it's different, and I think it's good to work with a professional. But I also believe, like for myself, I enjoy reading books on different things. There's a lot of good books out there on every subject that you want to go on. So if you can find some good books, it really helps. But also, I think, you know, really working on concentration. I think it's funny, if you go to every sport, you always hear everyone say focus. But focus is, you know, it's like not letting your thoughts control you in certain moments, which is a part of the game. Like, it's like if you're at 19-all, there is that pull. There's the pull. Am I going to lose? Am I going to win? Am I going to lose this set? And what happens if I lose? And what happens if I win? So I think it's really important. And I think, you know, like a meditation is very good for bouncing, because you focus on your breathing and that's staying in the moment, which is all these cliches that you hear, you know, as like offhand remarks, but they are so
cool. Important.
And it's once you go into more mental training, you start to learn more about it, but it's such a huge part of bouncing. But I think the best thing you can do is find, you know, a professional in this area, which is becoming more and more
common.
Yeah, because like the sport, like using a physio was really common, but then using someone for mental training wasn't
that common.
Yeah.
But now I think
but everyone would agree that it's mental, you know, is a huge part of the game. And something I wish I would have done a lot more when I was younger, because I think it's the same as everything, it's habits. And once you build them up, and the guys at the top, you really have to, you know, take your hat off to them. They are so mentally strong that they, you know, they really expect to win and they force wins. And their way of thinking, it would be nice if you could get in their head and see how they think in different situations. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes they can play in the toughest conditions and look as if they're not, you know, caring, but, you know, they're using different energies to get the right results.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating side of the game, but I think it's something everyone can improve.
Yeah. I think when you talk about those particular athletes that can do that, and the current one now, I think definitely Kento, in my perspective, I have a lot of respect for him, just purely because, yeah, he's a great player, but he's just got so much expectation on him, and he virtually, I wouldn't say he never loses, but there's not often where you just see him crack and he just plays terribly, unless he's super tired after a long run of tournaments. But he's just always there, and he's, I just find that really amazing as well.
Yeah, I think at the moment he's really hitting the mark, and you can see he looks so calm when you watch him play. Nobody knows, I'm not in connection with the Japanese culture or the way they work, but it's the way he plays is quite incredible, and his level of consistency is like really good, and that can only come from being physically good and obviously mentally
as well.
Very good, because you can see he can win one week on a Sunday, and the next, you know, he could be playing Tuesday or Wednesday again the next week, and his level
is still there.
And like even like to drop down from playing, of course your energy levels and everything is higher playing a final, but then he comes back on the Wednesday and he's back in the final the next Sunday, and he's winning again. And it's the same in the doubles with Kevin and Marcus, they just you know, they make it look so easy.
Yeah.
But it's very hard. You can see how quickly things can change. Because, like, as I've been playing, you know, you've seen times where Zhang Nam was controlling mixed, and now he's off the radar on mixed, and he's, you know, first round, second round men's doubles. But he's been world champion, Olympic champion in that. So it's crazy how things change.
Yeah.
And but these guys that do this week in, week out are really impressive.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And just based on what you've done in your career, so from a young age, and the successes that you've had, in terms of what drives you and keeps you going, what do you find that passion or that inner drive originates from? Like, what do you see? Is it the successes? Like, what do you see as success in yourself? So a lot of people will say success is winning. Some people will say success is being happy. Some people say success is being better today than I was yesterday. Some people it's money. Some people it's relationships, some people it's family. So what, for you, if we dig a bit deeper past the badminton for you and not just saying playing the Olympics or doing that. What's the deeper kind of meaning behind Sam McGee and what really makes you tick in terms of success?
I think for me, I just enjoy like getting better. I enjoy finding new ways to do different things. Like I'm always, you know, trying to find different ways to do things better. So at all these tournaments, I'm always learning. For me, I've never had something where I said, I really want to get that. It's never been like, get to an Olympics, that'd be great. Because I think it's like, everyone's different. People find that a huge achievement, and it would be a huge achievement, but I've always enjoyed just developing my game. I've always been someone that shows up to training motivated. And the days that I've showed up where I feel my motivation, I know I need to take a break, but it's one of those things where I've always enjoyed developing my game. As weird as it sounds, it's like, it's something that, I don't know, I just enjoy the challenge of finding new ways to do different things.
Yeah, I think that's reflected by the fact that you were saying read books before as well. Yeah. So reading books to learn things.
Yeah, I think that's crucial because you always get new ideas. And even if it's not the idea that you believe in or think about, it gets you thinking, okay, how could I do that differently? And that's the main thing. As a matter of success in my career, I'm quite happy with what I've achieved. I think the next levels are tough to get to. I think, you know, me and Chloe have been between 20 and 30. We've never, 21's been the highest. And that's probably a reflection of where our standard is. I think the next level is a lot of good players that are playing in good centers every day. And I would have hoped that me and Chloe maybe could have got to maybe 15 in the world. I think we had sometimes our level was there, but never consistently enough.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the reason, different reasons, and maybe not enough sparring or coming from a smaller country. I don't know. Or maybe I didn't do enough work. I'm not sure. But I do think that was, you know, one of the goals I would have had is to break the top 20.
Yeah.
And probably we're running out of time to do that now. But I'm happy that, you know, badminton Ireland never had a medal before at Europeans. And we were able to get three in European Games and one in an actual European Championships. And also when I was younger, I won the European Juniors, which is Ireland's had anything in that. So those things I'll be very proud of. And of course, winning certain challenge tournaments. Semi-final of German Open 1 year was a huge one for me, and basically putting Ireland on the map too was a huge thing, which I think a lot of players mightn't see it as an achievement at all, but from smaller countries it is big. And maybe we'll be, you know, like representing Ireland at these big tournaments is, I think, is good. You know, it can only be good for badminton Ireland, and I think well something we might miss when it's gone.
Yeah, I completely agree that being that representative from a country that has been never seen on those scenes, like European medals and European champion, junior champion, it feels good. As in, not just for yourself, but all of a sudden you put badminton on the map in Ireland, and the whole family's helped to do that. The McGee family has really contributed to badminton, so that's huge. And hopefully when you do decide to stop playing professionally, that you'll be able to continue that process in making badminton a bigger and better sport in Ireland.
Yeah, for sure. That would be something. I would be very sad if badminton Ireland were back to how it was. I've seen in other countries, like I know from Irwan and Richard's experience in Wales, you know, they had a really good centre going, and then all of a sudden, there's now nothing, and they're starting to build again. So I think if that happened in Ireland, it would seem like a waste. You know, like we put a lot of effort into getting medals and to get junior players into the centre, and I really hope, I think there is a lot of talent there, and the road is hard, but I hope that they can do it and keep passing it on to the next generation, because we have something there now and we have to build the centre as best we can, and it's not going to be easy. We're never going to be a country that has 40 players at these events.
Yeah,
I can't ever see
maybe,
that happening.
Maybe one day.
Maybe one day. I think it's taken a lot of years.
Maybe
40 years. It will take a long time, but I do hope that there's always something there for whatever kid has the ambition to be a top player. They can see, okay, I have a route in Ireland to do. I don't have to go abroad as much as possible. You know, I can still live at home and do my thing. So hopefully for the kids in Ireland, that will be possible.
Sure. So finishing up here, Sam, what is next for you? So yes, we're playing a lot of tournaments in this year to qualify for the 2020 Tokyo Olympic Games. What else is in store for you? Do you have anything else planned post-Olympic Games, or haven't thought about it yet?
I think after Olympics, me and Chloe will definitely stop. I don't know how we're going to, what way will happen if we will play with some younger players. I think Chloe will probably, you know, take some time off and maybe she will decide that's it. She's obviously 31, will be 32 then, and she wants to go down family route. It's a different away from mum. So then it's up to me whether I want to stay involved. And I will stay involved. How it will look then, because it is quite tough because you start at the bottom again, you know, and it's
with a new partner,
who's going to be younger. So it is, but I do want to stay active for a period of time to, you know, give back to help the younger ones, because there's some people there that, which is another side of Bamden, is tough when you're starting out.
Yeah,
you know, if you start out as 2 18-year-olds in men's doubles or mixed, you get lost so quick. Where you can see in the big centers, you know, they play with an older player, and all of a sudden the level comes quicker.
Yeah.
And if I can do that for someone who's keen and energetic and wants to take that opportunity, then I would like to do that. I can't see it being for 5 years or another cycle, but definitely for a period of time to hopefully help the game and hopefully just to be there in training and, you know, maybe pass it on.
Yeah, and just a good example of that is Marcus used to play Marcus Kido.
So I think if you look at a lot of players, a lot of centers, you know, examples, you can maybe see Chris Adcock play with Robert Blair and all of a sudden he's a world-class player when he was, you know, quite young. And there's lots of examples of it.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So, Sam, for someone listening, how would they be able to follow your progress and see how you're going?
I'm not a huge social media person. Twitter and a little bit of Facebook. But I think Bamden Ireland, they're posting a lot of our results on their Facebook, all their social medias. And their website as well. I think that's the best way to follow me because I'm not huge
into really Instagram or Facebook.
No, I'm not on Instagram at all. Okay. I'm not a huge fan of social media.
Sure.
I think it's a something where people are don't always show the they show one side of it.
Yeah, they show the full story.
Yeah, so I think something like this is really good because you can see what players go through at tournaments. And it's the side of things the tournament software doesn't show.
There's
a lot more than just seeing a result and it's the training behind it, going to tournaments, the logistics, all these things.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not on social media. Maybe I should be on social media to show that side of it too, but it's not for me. But I think the best way to follow me is through all Bamden Ireland's platforms. So that's a good plug for them.
Sure thing. Go Badminton Ireland.
Yeah.
So from everyone at the Badminton Podcast, so Henry and myself, thanks so much for being on this episode. And I think, it's just really gotten me thinking about how a country will actually build badminton. And it is about having families like yours, the McGee family, to have some really good players in there that show the way, show the pathway for people. And of course, from an administration point of view, having people like Richard to really put some structures in place, get some centralized training centers. But I've really enjoyed having a chat today. So thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me.
So for everyone listening, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of the Badminton Podcast. We're going to continue on this route and try to get as many professional players as we can, because they do bring a huge insight to not only, like what Sam said, not only what we see on the results and tournament software or on YouTube, but also about what goes in their lives and what drives them and where they started from, because every professional athlete would have started as a beginner at some stage, and it's really interesting to hear their stories. So make sure you share this podcast with everyone who you think will benefit from it, and if you've enjoyed it, and if you want to get in contact with us, you can contact us, Volantware, on our social media. We use social media, Sam, sorry about that. So Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, as well as LinkedIn. And we're also on TikTok. I don't know how it works, Henry deals with that. But our social media handle is Volantware, V-O-L-A-N-T-W-E-A-R. And you can also contact us on our website, www.volantware.com. So thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
Cheers. Bye.
This podcast was brought to you by Volantware, the most versatile badminton apparel you'll ever own.